to her side of the suite. "I was afraid of this," she whispered gravely, like a surgeon telling a patient's family member that they'd found something horrible upon opening the chest cavity.
"She can't be serious. It's 4 o'clock on Friday. The party starts at 7. It's black tie, for Christ's sake. There is no way on earth she expects me to go."
I looked again at my watch in disbelief and tried to remember her exact words.
"Oh, she's quite serious," she said, picking up the phone. "I'll help you, okay? You go find the review in the Washington Post and get her a copy before she leaves. Yuri is coming for her soon to take her home for her hair and makeup. I'll get you a dress and everything else you need for tonight. Don't worry. We'll figure it out."
She began rapid-fire dialing and whispering urgent-sounding instructions into the phone. I stood and stared, but she waved her hand without looking up, and I snapped back to reality.
"Go," she whispered,
looking at me with a rare hint of sympathy. And I went. Chapter 14.
"You can't show up in a cab," Lily said to me as I jabbed helplessly at my eyes with my brand new Maybelline Great Lash mascara. "This is black tie. Call a car, for Christ's sake."
She watched for a minute more and then grabbed the clumpy wand from my hand and tapped my eyelids closed.
"I guess you're right," I sighed,
still refusing to accept that my Friday night was to be spent in a formal gown at the Met, greeting wealthy but still rednecks from Georgia, North and South Carolina, and plastering fake smile after fake smile on my poorly made-up face. The announcement had left me all of 3 hours to find a dress, buy makeup, get ready, and revamp all my weekend plans, and in the craziness of the situation, I'd forgotten to arrange transportation. Luckily, working at one of the biggest fashion magazines in the country, the job a million girls would die for, has its advantages, and by 4:40 p.m., I was the proud borrower of a knockout floor-length black Oscar de la Renta number, provided kindly by Jeffy, closet maven and lover of all things feminine.
"Girl, you go black tie, you go Oscar, and that's that. Now don't be shy, take those pants off and try this on for Jeffy."
I began to unbutton, and he shuddered. I asked him if he really found my half-naked body that repulsive, and he said of course not. It was merely my panty lines that he found so disgusting. The fashion assistants had already called in a pair of silver Manolos in my size, and someone in accessories had selected a flashy silver Judith Lieber evening bag with a long clanking chain. I'd expressed interest in an understated Calvin Klein clutch, but she snorted at the suggestion and handed me the Judith. Steph was debating whether I should wear a choker or a pendant, and Allison, the newly promoted beauty editor, was on the phone with her manicurist, who made office calls.
"She'll meet you in the conference room at 4:45, Allison said when I picked up my extension. "You're wearing black, right? Insist on Chanel Ruby Red. Just tell her to bill us."
The entire office had worked itself up into a nearly hysterical frenzy trying to make me look appropriate for the night's gala affair. It certainly wasn't because they all adored me so much and killed themselves trying to help me out. Rather, they knew Miranda had mandated the makeover and were eager to prove to her the high level of their taste and class. Lily finished her charity makeup lesson, and I briefly wondered if I looked ridiculous wearing a floor-length Oscar de la Renta gown and Bonnie Bell lip smackers and fudgesicle. Probably, but I had turned down all offers of having a makeup artist come to the apartment. Everyone on staff tried to insist, and none too subtly, but I adamantly refused. Even I had limits. I hobbled into the bedroom on my 4-inch Manolo stilettos and kissed Alex on the forehead. He barely looked up from the magazine he was reading.
"I'll definitely be home by 11, so we can go get some dinner or drinks then, okay? I'm sorry I have to do this. I really am. If you do decide to go out with the guys, call so I can come meet you, okay?"
He had, as promised, come directly from school to spend the night together, and hadn't been all that thrilled when I'd arrived home with the news that he could definitely have a relaxing night at home, but that I wouldn't be a part of the plans. He was sitting on the balcony off my bedroom, reading an old copy of Vanity Fair we had lying around,
and drinking one of the beers Lily kept in the fridge for guests. It wasn't until after I'd explained that I had to work tonight that I even noticed he and Lily weren't hanging out. "Where is she?" I asked. "She has no classes, and I know she's not working Fridays all summer." Alex took a swig of his pale ale and shrugged.
"I'm guessing she's here. Her door's closed, but I saw some guy walking around before."
"Some guy? Could you be a little more descriptive? What guy?" I wondered if someone had broken in, or perhaps Freudian boy had finally been invited over.
"I don't know, but he's scary-looking. Tattoos, piercings, wife-beater, the whole nine. Can't imagine where she met this one."
He took another nonchalant swig.
I couldn't imagine where she'd found him, either, considering I'd left her at 11 the night before in the company of a very polite guy named William, who, as far as I could see, was not a wife-beater-wearing, tattoo-donning kind of guy.
"Alex, seriously, you're telling me there's some thug cruising around my apartment, a thug who may or may not have been invited over, and you don't care? This is ridiculous. We need to do something," I said, getting up from the chair and wondering, as always, if the weight shift was going to cause the balcony to fall off the side of the building.
"Andy, relax. He's definitely not a thug." He flipped a page. "He might be a punk grunge freak, but he's not a thug."
"Great. That's just fucking great. Now, are you going to come see what's going on, or are you just going to sit there all night?" He still refused to look at me, and I finally understood how annoyed he was about tonight. Understandable, entirely. But I was just as irritated to have to work, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it.
"Why don't you call me if you need me?"
"Fine," I huffed and made a big production of storming inside. "Don't feel guilty when you find my dismembered body on the bathroom floor. Really, no big deal." I stomped inside and around the apartment for a little while, looking for evidence of this guy's presence. The only thing that seemed at all out of place was an empty bottle of Kettle One in the sink. Had she really managed to buy, open, and drink an entire bottle of vodka sometime after midnight last night? I knocked on her door. No response. I knocked a little more insistently, and I heard a guy's voice state the very obvious fact that someone was knocking on the door. When still no one responded, I turned the doorknob. "Hello? Anyone home here?" I called out, trying not to look inside the room, but only being able to hold out for about 5 seconds. My eyes skipped over the two pairs of jeans that were tangled up on the floor, and the bra that was hanging from the desk chair, and the overflowing ashtray that made the room stink like a frat house, and went directly to the bed, where my best friend was stretched out on her side, back to me, completely naked. A sickly-looking guy with a line of sweat above his lip and a head full of greasy hair blended into her sheets. His dozens of snaking, winding, scary tattoos acted as the perfect camouflage against her green and blue plaid comforter. There was a gold hoop through his eyebrow, much glittering metal from each ear, and two small rounded spikes coming out of his chin. Thankfully, he was wearing a pair of boxers, but they looked so dirty and dingy and old that I almost wished he weren't. He pulled on his cigarette, exhaled slowly and meaningfully, and nodded in my general direction.
"Yo," he said, waving his cigarette toward me. "You mind shutting the door there, my friend?"
What? My friend? Was this sleazy-looking Aussie actually giving me attitude? "Are you smoking crack?" I asked, no longer interested in manners of any sort, and not at all scared. He was shorter than me and couldn't have weighed more than 130. As far as I could tell, the worst thing he could do to me at that point would be to touch me. I shuddered when I thought about the myriad ways he'd probably touched Lily, who was still sleeping soundly underneath his protective hover. "Who the hell do you think you are? This is my apartment, and I'd like you to leave, now," I added, my courage fueled by the time demands. I had exactly 1 hour to get gorgeous for the single most stressful night of my career, and dealing with this strung-out freak had not been part of the game plan.
"Dude, chill out," he breathed and inhaled again. "It doesn't look like your friend here wants me to leave."
"She would want you to leave if she happened to be conscious, you asshole," I screamed, horrified that Lily had, in all likelihood, had sex with this guy.
I assure you, I speak for both of us when I say, get the fuck out of our apartment.
I felt a hand on my shoulder and whipped around to see Alex looking concerned, checking out the situation.
Andy, why don't you get in the shower and let me take care of this, okay?
Although no one could call him a big guy, he looked like a pro wrestler compared to the emaciated mess that was currently nuzzling his facial metal against my best friend's bare back.
I want him, I pointed here just to be clear, out of my apartment.
I know you do, and I think he's about ready to leave, too, aren't you, buddy?
Alex asked, in the kind of soothing voice you'd use with a rabid-looking dog you were frightened of upsetting.
Dude, no issues here. Just having a little fun with Lily's all. She was all over me last night at O-Bar. Ask anyone, they'll tell you. Fucking begged me to come back with her.
I doubt that, Alex said soothingly. She's a really friendly girl when she wants to be, but sometimes she gets too drunk to know what she's doing. So, as your friend, I'm gonna have to ask you to leave now.
The freak mashed his cigarette out and made a big show of throwing up his hands in mock surrender.
Dude, no problem whatsoever. I'll just take a quick shower and give my little Lily here a proper goodbye, and then I'll be on my way.
He swung his legs over the side of the bed and reached for the towel that hung next to her desk. Alex moved forward, swiftly removed the towel from his hands, and looked him directly in the eye.
No, I think you should leave now. Right now.
And in a way that I'd never seen him do in the almost 3 years I'd known him, he placed himself squarely in front of Freak Boy and allowed his height to insinuate the threat that was clearly intended.
Dude, no worries. I'm out of here.
He crooned after taking one look at Alex and realizing he had to crane his neck to look at his face.
Just get myself dressed and out the door.
He picked up his jeans from the floor and located his ripped-up t-shirt from underneath Lily's still exposed body. She moved when he pulled it out from under her, and a few seconds later, her eyes managed to open.
Cover her,
Alex commanded gruffly, now clearly enjoying his new role as threatening man in charge. And without comment, Freak Boy pulled the cover over her shoulders so that only a tangle of her black curls was visible.
What's going on?
Lily croaked while willing her eyes to stay open. She turned to see me trembling in anger in her doorway, Alex hulking about doing manly poses, and Freak Boy scrambling to tie his blue and canary yellow Diadoras and get the hell out before things got really ugly. Too late. Her gaze stopped on Freak Boy.
Who the hell are you?
She asked him, bolting upright without even realizing that she was now completely naked. Alex and I instinctively turned away while she pulled the covers up, looking shocked, but Freak Boy grinned lecherously and ogled her breasts.
Baby, you telling me you don't remember who I am?
He asked, his thick Australian accent becoming less adorable with every passing second.
You sure knew who I was last night.
He walked over to her and looked like he was about to sit down on the bed, but Alex had already grabbed his arm and pulled him upright.
Out, now, or I'm gonna have to carry you myself, he commanded, looking tough and very cute and not a little proud of himself.
Freak Boy threw up his hands and made clucking noises.
I'm out of here. Call me sometime, Lily. You were great last night.
He moved quickly through the bedroom door toward the living room with Alex in pursuit.
Man, she sure as hell is a feisty one,
I heard him say to Alex right before the front door slammed shut, but it didn't appear that Lily had heard. She had pulled on a t-shirt and managed to pull herself out of bed.
Lily, who the hell was that? He was the biggest jerk I've ever met, not to mention absolutely disgusting.
She shook her head slowly and appeared to be concentrating very hard, trying to remember where he'd entered her life.
Disgusting. You're right, he is absolutely disgusting. And I have no idea what happened. I remember you leaving last night and talking to some really nice guy in a suit. We were doing shots of Jaeger for some reason. And that's it.
Lily, just imagine how drunk you had to be to agree not only to have sex with someone who looks like that, but to bring him back to our apartment.
I thought I was pointing out the obvious, but her eyes widened into surprised realization.
You think I had sex with him?
she asked softly, refusing to acknowledge what seemed certain. Alex's words from a few months before came back to me. Lily did drink more than was normal. All the signs were there. She was missing classes regularly, had gotten arrested, and now had dragged home the scariest-looking mutant of a guy I'd ever laid eyes on. I also remembered the message one of her professors had left on our machine right after finals, something to the effect that while Lily's final paper had been stellar, she'd missed too many classes and handed things in too late to give her the A she deserved. I decided to tread carefully.
Lil, sweetie, I don't think the problem is the guy. I think it's the drinking that's causing it.
She had begun brushing her hair, and it wasn't until now that I realized it was already 6 o'clock on a Friday night, and she was just getting out of bed. She wasn't protesting, so I continued.
It's not that I have any issue with drinking, I said, trying to keep the conversation relatively peaceful. Clearly, I'm not anti-drinking. I just wonder if it's gotten a little bit out of control lately, you know? Has everything been okay at school?
She opened her mouth to say something, but Alex popped his head in the door and handed me my shrieking cell phone.
It's her, he said, and left again.
Oh, that woman had a very special gift for wrecking my life.
Sorry, I said to Lily, looking at the phone warily as the display screamed MP cell over and over again.
It usually only takes a second for her to humiliate or reprimand me, so hold that thought.
Lily set down her brush and watched me answer. Moran, again, I'd almost answered the line as though it were her own.
This is Andrea, I corrected, bracing for the barrage.
Andrea, you know I expect you here at 6:30 tonight, do you not?
She barked into the phone without a greeting or identification of any sort.
Oh, you had said 7 o'clock earlier. I still need to...
I said 6:30 before, and I'm saying it again now. 6:30, get it?
Click. She hung up. I looked at my watch. 6:05 p.m. This was a problem. She wants me there in 25 minutes, I stated out loud to no one in particular. Lily looked relieved for the distraction.
Let's get you moving then, okay?
We're mid-conversation here, and this is important. What were you going to say before?
The words were right, but it was clear to both of us that my mind was already a million miles away. I'd already decided there was no time to shower, as I now had 15 minutes to zip myself into black tie and get into a car.
Seriously, Andy, you've got to move. Go get ready. We'll do this later.
And once again, I was left with no choice but to move quickly, heart racing, climbing into my gown and running a brush through my hair and trying to match some of the names with the pictures of the evening's guests that Emily had helpfully printed out earlier. Lily watched the whole thing unwind with mild amusement, but I knew she was worrying about the incident with Freak Boy, and I felt terrible I couldn't deal with it right then. Alex was on the phone with his little brother, trying to convince him that he really was too young to go to a movie at 9 o'clock, and that their mother wasn't cruel in forbidding him to do so. I kissed him on the cheek as he whistled and told me that he'd probably meet some people for dinner, but to call him later if I wanted to meet up, and ran, as best one can, in stilts, back to the living room, where Lily was holding a gorgeous piece of black silk fabric. I looked at her questioningly.
"A wrap for your big night," she sang, shaking it out like a bedsheet. "I want my Andy to look just as sophisticated as all the big-money Carolina rednecks she'll be serving tonight like a common waitress. My grandmother bought it for me years ago to wear to Eric's wedding. I can't decide if it's gorgeous or hideous, but it's black tie enough, and it's Chanel, so it should do."
I hugged her.
"Just promise, if Miranda kills me for saying the wrong thing, that you'll burn this dress and make sure I'm buried in my brown sweatpants. Promise me."
She grabbed the mascara wand I was waving about and started working on me.
"You look great, Andy. Really, you do. Never thought I'd see you in an Oscar gown going to one of Miranda Priestley's parties, but hey, you look the part. Now go."
She handed me the dangling, obnoxiously bright Judith Lieber bag and held the door as I walked into the hallway.
"Have fun."
The car was waiting outside my building, and John, who was shaping up to be a first-class pervert,
whistled as the driver held the door open for me.
Knock 'em dead, hottie,
he called after me with an exaggerated wink.
See you late night.
He had no idea where I was going, of course, but it was comforting that he thought I'd at least be coming home. Maybe it won't be that bad, I thought as I settled into the cushy back seat of the town car. But then my dress slid up over my knees and the back of my legs touched the ice-cold leather seats and I lurched forward. Or maybe it will suck just as much as I think it will. The driver jumped out and ran around to open the door for me, but I was standing on the curb by the time he'd made it around. I'd been to the Met once before, on a day trip to New York with my mom and Jill, to see some of the tourist sites. I didn't remember any of the actual exhibits we saw that day, only how much my new shoes had hurt by the time we got there. But I recalled the never-ending white staircase out front, and the feeling that I could climb those stairs forever. The stairs stood where I remembered them, but looked different in the haze of dusk. Still accustomed to the short, miserable days of winter, I thought it seemed strange that the sky was just darkening and it was already 6:30. That night, the stairs looked positively regal. They were prettier than the Spanish Steps or the ones outside the library at Columbia or even the awe-inspiring spread at the Capitol Building in D.C. It wasn't until I'd made it to about the tenth of one of those white beauties that I began to loathe them. What cruel, cruel sadist would make a woman in a skin-tight floor-length gown and spiked heels climb such a hill of hell? Since I couldn't very well hate the architect or even the museum official who'd commissioned them, I was forced to hate Miranda, who could usually be blamed for directly or indirectly causing all the misery and bad will in my life. The top felt like a mile away, and I flashed back to the spinning classes I used to take when I still had time to go to the gym. Some Nazi instructor would sit atop her little bike and bark out orders in perfect military staccato. Pump, pump, and breathe, breathe. Climb, people, climb that hill. You're almost to the top. Don't lose it now. Climb for your life. I closed my eyes and tried to envision pedaling instead. The wind in my hair, running over the instructor, but climbing, still climbing. Oh, anything to forget the fiery pain that shot from little toe to heel to back again. 10 more steps. That was all that was left. Just 10 more. Oh, God. Was that wetness in my shoes blood? Would I have to walk before Miranda in a sweaty Oscar gown and bloody feet? Please, oh please, say that I was almost there and... there. The top. The feeling of victory was no less than of a world-class sprinter who just won her first gold medal. I inhaled mightily, clenched my fingers to fight off the urge for a victory cigarette, and reapplied my fudgesicle lip smackers. It was time to be a lady. The guard opened the door for me, bowed slightly, and smiled. He probably thought I was a guest.
I miss you, must be Andrea. Ilana said to have a seat right over there, and she'll be out in a minute.
He turned away and spoke discreetly into a microphone on his sleeve, and nodded when he heard a response through his earpiece.
Yes, right over there, miss. She'll be here as soon as she can.
I looked around the enormous entryway, but didn't feel like going through the dress adjustment hassle of actually sitting. Besides, when would I ever again have the chance to be in the Metropolitan Museum of Art after hours with apparently no one else there? The ticket booths were empty and the ground-level galleries dark, but the sense of history, of culture, was awesome. The silence itself was deafening. After nearly 15 minutes of peering around, being careful not to wander too far from the aspiring Secret Service agent, a rather ordinary-looking girl in a long navy dress crossed the massive foyer and walked toward me. I was surprised that someone with a job as glamorous as hers, working in the special events office of the museum, could be so plain, and I felt instantly ridiculous, like a girl from a small town trying to dress for a big-city black-tie affair, which, ironically enough, was exactly who I was. Ilana, on the other hand,
looked like she hadn't even bothered to change out of her work clothes, and I learned later that she hadn't.
"Why bother?" she'd laughed. "It's not like these people are here to look at me."
Her brown hair was clean and straight, but lacking in style, and her brown flats were horrifically unfashionable. But her blue eyes were bright and kind, and I knew instantly that I would like her.
"You must be Alana," I said, sensing that I somehow had seniority in the situation and was expected to take charge.
"I'm Andrea. I'm Miranda's assistant, and I'm here to help in any way I can."
She looked so relieved. I instantly wondered what Miranda had said to her. The possibilities were endless, but I imagined it had something to do with Alana's Ladies' Home Journal getup. I shuddered to think what wicked things she'd uttered to such a sweet girl and prayed she wouldn't start to cry. Instead, she turned to me with those big, innocent eyes, leaned forward, and declared none too quietly, "Your boss is a first-rate bitch." I stared, shocked, for just a moment before recovering.
"She is, isn't she?" I said, and we both laughed. "What do you need me to do? Miranda's going to be able to sense that I'm here in about 10 seconds, so I should look like I'm doing something."
"Here, I'll show you the table," she said, walking down a darkened hallway toward the Egyptian exhibits. "It's dynamite." We arrived in a smaller gallery, perhaps the size of a tennis court, with a rectangular 24-seat table stretched down the middle. Robert Isabel was worth it, I could see. He was the New York party planner, the only one who could be trusted to strike just the right note with astonishing attention to detail. Fashionable without being trendy, luxe but not ostentatious, unique without being over the top. Miranda insisted that Robert do everything, but the only time I'd ever seen his work before was at Cassidy and Caroline's birthday party. I knew he could manage to turn Miranda's colonial-style living room into a chic downtown lounge, complete with soda bar, in martini glasses, of course, ultra suede, built-in banquettes, and a fully heated, tented balcony dance floor with a Moroccan theme. For 10-year-olds. But this was truly spectacular. Everything glowed white. Light white. Smooth white. Bright white. Textured white. And rich white. Bundles of milky white peonies looked as if they grew from the table itself, deliciously lush but low enough to allow people to talk over them. Bone white china, with a white checked pattern, rested on a crisp white linen tablecloth, and high-backed white oak chairs were covered in luscious white suede, the danger, all atop a plush white carpet, specially laid for the evening. White votive candles in simple white porcelain holders gave off a soft white light, highlighting, but somehow not burning, the peonies from underneath and providing subtle, unobtrusive illumination around the table. The only color in the entire room came from the elaborate, multi-hued canvases that hung on the walls surrounding the table. Shocking blues and greens and golds from the depictions of early Egyptian life. The white table, as a deliberate contrast to the priceless, detailed paintings, was exquisite. As I turned my head around to take in the wonderful contrast of the color and the white, that Robert really is a genius. A vibrant red figure caught my eye. In the corner, standing ramrod straight, under a looming painting, was Miranda, wearing the beaded red Chanel that had been commissioned, cut, fitted, and pre-cleaned just for tonight. And although it'd be a stretch to say that it had been worth every penny, since those pennies added up to tens of thousands of dollars, she did look breathtaking. She herself was an objet d'art, chin jutted upward and muscles perfectly taut, a neoclassical relief in beaded Chanel silk. She wasn't beautiful, her eyes were a bit too beady and her hair too severe, and her face much too hard. But she was stunning, in a way I couldn't make sense of, and no matter how hard I tried to play it cool, to pretend to be admiring the room, I couldn't take my eyes off her. As usual, the sound of her voice broke my reverie.
"Andrea, you do know the names and faces of our guests this evening, do you not? I assume you have properly studied their portraits.
I expect you won't humiliate me tonight by failing to greet someone by name, she announced, looking nowhere, with only my name indicating that her words might somehow be directed toward me.
Yes, I've got it covered, I answered, suppressing the urge to salute and still acutely aware that I was staring. I'll take a few minutes now and make sure I'm positive.
She looked at me as if to say, You sure will, you idiot. And I forced myself to look away and walk out of the gallery. Ilana was right behind me.
What's she talking about? She whispered, leaning toward me. Portraits? Is she crazy?
We sat down on an uncomfortable wooden bench in a darkened hallway, both of us overwhelmed with the need to hide.
Oh, that. Yeah, normally I would have spent the last week trying to find pictures of the guests tonight and memorizing them so I could greet them by name, I explained to a horrified Ilana. She stared at me incredulously. But since she just told me I had to come today, I only had a few minutes in the car to look them over.
What? I asked. You think this is strange? Whatever. It's standard stuff for a Miranda party.
Well, I thought there wouldn't be anyone famous here tonight, she said, referring to Miranda's past parties at the Met. Since she was a huge contributor, Miranda was often granted the very special privilege of renting out, the Metropolitan Museum of Art for private parties and cocktail hours. Mr. Tomlinson had had to ask only once, and Miranda was scrambling to make her brother-in-law's party the best the Met had ever seen. She figured it would impress the rich Southerners and their trophy wives to dine for a night at the Met. She was right.
Yeah, there won't be anyone we'd recognize right away, just a lot of billionaires with homes below the Mason-Dixon line. Usually when I have to memorize the guests' faces, they're easier to find online or in WWD or something. I mean, you can generally locate a picture of Queen Noor or Michael Bloomberg or Yohei Yamamoto if you have to. But just try to find Mr. and Mrs. Packard from some rich suburb of Charleston or wherever the hell they live, and it's not so easy. Miranda's other assistant was looking for these people while everyone else was getting me ready, and she eventually found almost everyone in the society pages of their hometown newspapers or on various companies' websites. But it was really annoying. Ilana continued to stare. I think somehow I knew that I was sounding like a robot, but I couldn't stop. Her shock only made me feel worse. There's only one couple I haven't identified yet, so I guess I'll know them by default, I said.
Oh, my. I don't know how you do it. I'm annoyed I have to be here on a Friday night, but I can't imagine doing your job. How do you take it? How do you stand being spoken to and treated like that?
It took me a moment to realize that this question caught me off guard. No one had really ever volunteered anything negative about my job. I'd always thought I was the only one, among the millions of imaginary girls that would die for my job, who saw anything remotely disturbing about my situation. It was more horrifying to see the shock in her eyes than it was to witness the hundreds of ridiculous things I saw each and every day at work. The way she looked at me with that pure, unadulterated pity triggered something inside me. I did what I hadn't done in months of working under subhuman conditions for a non-human boss, what I always managed to keep suppressed for a more appropriate time. I started to cry. Ilana looked more shocked than ever.
Oh, sweetie, come here. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean anything by it. You're a saint for putting up with that witch, you hear me? Come with me.
She pulled me by the hand and led me down another darkened hallway toward an office in the back.
Here. Now sit for a minute and forget all about what these stupid people look like.
I sniffled and started to feel stupid.
And don't feel strange, you hear? I have a feeling you kept that inside for a long, long time. And you have to have a good cry every now and then.
She was fumbling around in her desk for something while I tried to wipe the mascara from my cheeks.
Here, she proclaimed proudly.
I'm destroying this right after you see it, and if you even think of telling anyone about it, I'll wreck your life. But just look, it's amazing. She handed me a manila envelope sealed with a confidential sticker and smiled.
I tore off the sticker and pulled a green folder out. Inside was a photo, a color photocopy, actually, of Miranda stretched out on a restaurant banquette. I recognized it immediately as a picture taken by a famous society photographer during a recent birthday party for Donna Karan at Pastis. It had already appeared on the pages of New York Magazine and was bound to keep showing up. In it, she was wearing her signature brown and white snakeskin trench coat, the one I always thought made her look like a snake. Well, it seems I wasn't alone, because in this version, someone had subtly, expertly, attached a scaled-to-size cutout of a rattlesnake's rattle directly where her legs should have been. The effect was a fabulous rendition of Miranda as Snake. She rested her elbow on the banquette, cradled her chiseled chin in her palm, and stretched out across the leather, with her rattle curled in a semicircle and hanging off the edge of the bench. It was perfect. "Isn't it great?" Elena asked, leaning over my shoulder. Linda came into my office one afternoon. She'd just spent the entire day on the phone with Miranda, selecting which gallery they'd dine in. Linda naturally insisted on one gallery because it's by far the best size and most beautiful, but Miranda mandated that it had to be held in the other one near the gift shop. They went back and forth for a while before Linda finally, after days of negotiations, got permission from the board to hold it in Miranda's gallery, and she was so excited to call Miranda and tell her the great news. Guess what happened when... "She changed her mind, obviously," I said quietly, feeling her irritation. "She decided to do exactly as Linda suggested in the first place, but only once she was sure everyone would jump through all her hoops." "Precisely. Well, this irritated the hell out of me. I'd never seen the entire museum turn itself upside down for anyone. I mean, Christ, the President of the United States could ask to have a State Department dinner here, and they wouldn't let him. And then your boss thinks she can march in and order everyone around, make our lives a living hell for days on end. Anyway, I made this pretty little picture as a pick-me-up for Linda. You know what she did with it? Shrunk it on the copier so she could have a little one for her wallet. I just thought you'd get a kick out of this, even if it's just to remind you that you're not alone. You're definitely the worst off, but you're not alone." I stuck the picture back in its confidential envelope and handed it back to Ilana. "You're the best," I said, touching her shoulder. "I really, really appreciate it. I promise to never, ever tell anyone where I got this, but will you please send this to me? I don't think it'll fit in the Lieber bag, but I'll give anything if you'd send it to me at home. Please?" She smiled and motioned for me to write my address. And we both stood up and walked, I hobbled, back to the museum's foyer. It was just about 7, and the guests were due to arrive any minute. Miranda and B-Dad were talking to his brother, the honored guest and groom, who looked like he had played soccer, football, lacrosse, and rugby at a southern school, one where he was always surrounded by cooing blondes. The cooing blonde of 26 who was to become his bride was standing quietly by his side, gazing up at him adoringly. She was holding a snifter of something and chortling at his jokes. Miranda was hanging on to B-Dad's forearm with the fakest of smiles plastered across her face. I didn't have to hear what they were saying to know that she was barely responding at the appropriate time. Social graces were not her strength, as she had little tolerance for small talk. But I knew she'd be on her best kiss-ass behavior tonight. I'd come to realize that her friends all fell into one of two categories. There were those she perceived as above her and who must be impressed. This list was short, but it generally included people like Irv Ravitz, Oscar de la Renta, Hillary Clinton, and any first-rate A-list movie star. Then there were those below her, who must be patronized and belittled, so they don't forget their place, which included basically everyone else. All runway employees, all family members, all parents of her children's friends, unless they coincidentally fell into category number 1, almost all designers and other magazine editors, and every single solitary person in the service industry, both here and abroad. Tonight was sure to be amusing because these were Category 2 people who would have to be treated like Category 1s merely because of their association with Mr. Tomlinson and his brother. I always enjoyed the rare occasions when I got to watch Miranda try to impress those around her, mostly because she wasn't naturally charming. I felt the first guests arrive before I saw them. The tension in the room was palpable. Remembering my color printouts, I rushed over to the couple and offered to take the woman's for a wrap. "Mr. and Mrs. Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Please, I'll take that, and Alana here will show you to the atrium where cocktails are being served." I hoped I wasn't staring during my monologue, but the spectacle was truly outrageous. I'd seen women dressed like hookers and men dressed like women and models not dressed at all at Miranda's parties, but never before had I seen people dressed like this. I knew it wasn't going to be a trendy New York crowd, but I was expecting them to look like something out of Dallas. Instead, they looked like a dressier version of the cast from Deliverance. Mr. Tomlinson's brother, himself distinguished-looking with silver hair, made the horrible mistake of wearing white tails, in May no less, with a plaid handkerchief and a cane. His fiancée had on an emerald-green taffeta nightmare. It swirled and puffed and gathered and forced her enormous bust up and over the top of the dress so that it appeared her own silicone breasts might actually suffocate her. Diamonds the size of Dixie cups hung from her ears, and an even larger one sparkled from her left hand. Her hair was bleached white with peroxide, as were her teeth, and her heels were so high and so skinny, she walked as if she'd been a running back in the NFL for the past 12 years.
"Darlings, I'm so delighted you could join us for a little party. Everyone loves parties now, don't they?"
Miranda sang in a falsetto voice. The soon-to-be Mrs. Tomlinson looked as if she'd pass out. Right there before her was the one and only Miranda Priestley. Her glee embarrassed us all, and the whole wretched crowd moved into the atrium with Miranda leading the way. The rest of the night went on much like the beginning. I recognized all the guests' names and managed not to utter anything too humiliating. The parade of white tuxes, chiffon, big hair, bigger jewels, and barely post-adolescent women ceased to amuse me as the hours wore on. But I never grew tired of watching Miranda. She was the true lady and the envy of every woman in that museum that night. And even though they understood that all the money in the world could never buy them her class and elegance, they never stopped wanting it. I smiled genuinely when she dismissed me halfway through dinner, as usual, without a thank you or a good night.
"Andrea, we won't be needing you any more this evening. See yourself out."
I looked for Alana, but she had already sneaked out. The car took only about 10 minutes to arrive after I called for it. I'd briefly considered taking the subway, but wasn't sure how well the Oscar or my feet would have held up, and I sunk, exhausted but calm, into the back seat. When I walked past John on my way to the elevator, he reached under his little table and pulled out a manila envelope.
"Just got this a few minutes ago. It says urgent."
I thanked him and sat down in a corner of the lobby, wondering who would be messengering me something at 10 o'clock on a Friday night. I tore it open and pulled out a note. "Dearest Andrea, it was so great to meet you tonight. Can we please get together next week for sushi or something? I dropped this off on my way home, figured you could use the pick-me-up after a night like the one we just had. Enjoy. XOXO, Ilana." Inside was the picture of Miranda as Snake, only Ilana had enlarged this one to a 10x13 size. I looked at it carefully for a few minutes, massaging the feet I'd finally pulled from the Manolos, and looked into Miranda's eyes. She looked intimidating and mean and just like the bitch I stared at every day, but tonight she'd also looked sad and not a little lonely. Adding this picture to my fridge and making fun of it with Lily and Alex wasn't going to make my feet hurt any less or give me back my Friday night. I tore it up and hobbled upstairs. Chapter 15.
Andrea, it's Emily, I heard a voice croak from the phone. Can you hear me?
It had been months since Emily had called me at home late at night, so I knew it had to be serious.
Hi, sure, you sound like hell, I said, bolting upright in bed, immediately wondering if Miranda had done something to make her sound that way.
The last time Emily had called this late was when Miranda had called her at 11 on a Saturday night to demand that Emily charter her and Mr. Tomlinson a private jet to get home from Miami, since bad weather had canceled their regularly scheduled flight. Emily was just getting ready to leave her apartment to attend her own birthday party when the call came in, and she'd immediately called me and begged me to deal with it. I hadn't gotten a message until the next day, though, and when I called her back, she was still in tears.
I missed my own birthday party, Andrea, she wailed the second she picked up the phone. I missed my own birthday party because I had to charter them a flight.
They couldn't get a hotel room for one night and come back the next day like normal people, I'd asked, pointing out the obvious.
Don't you think I thought of that? I had penthouse suites reserved for them at the Shore Club, the Albion, the Delano, within 7 minutes of her first phone call, figuring she couldn't possibly be serious. I mean, my God, it was a Saturday night. How the hell do you charter a flight on a Saturday night?
I'm guessing she wasn't so into that idea, I'd asked soothingly, feeling genuinely guilty that I hadn't been around to help her out, and simultaneously ecstatic that I'd dodged that particular bullet.
Yeah, not so into it at all. She called every 10 minutes, demanding to know why I hadn't found her anything yet, and I had to keep putting these people on hold to answer her call, and when I went back to them, they'd hang up. She gulped air. It was a nightmare.
So what finally happened? I'm almost scared to ask.
What finally happened? What didn't finally happen? I called every single private charter company in the state of Florida, and as you might imagine, they weren't answering their phones at midnight on a Saturday. I paged individual pilots. I called domestic airlines to see if they had any recommendations. I even managed to talk to some sort of supervisor at the Miami International Airport. Told him I needed a plane in the next half hour to fly two people to New York. Know what he did?
What?
He laughed. Hysterically. Accused me of being a front for terrorists, for drug smugglers, everything. Told me I had a better chance of getting hit by lightning exactly 20 times than I did of securing a plane and a pilot at that hour, regardless of how much I was willing to pay. And that if I called back again, he'd be forced to direct my inquiry to the FBI. Do you believe it?
She was screaming at this point.
Do you fucking believe it? The FBI!
And I assume Miranda didn't like that either.
Yeah, she loved that one. She spent 20 minutes refusing to believe that there wasn't a single plane available. I assured her that it wasn't that they were all taken, just that it was a difficult time of night to be attempting to charter a flight.
So what happened? I didn't see this one ending happily.
At about 1:30 in the morning, she finally accepted that she wasn't going to get home that night. Not that it mattered whatsoever, since the girls were with their father and the nanny was around all day Sunday if they needed her. And she had me buy her a ticket for the first flight out in the morning.
This was puzzling. If her flight had been canceled, I'd assumed the airlines would have rescheduled her for the first flight out in the morning, especially considering her Premier Advantage Plus Gold Platinum Diamond Executive VIP mileage status and the original cost of her first-class tickets. I said as much.
Yeah, well, Continental scheduled them for their first flight out, which was at 6:50 a.m. But when Miranda heard that someone else had managed to get on a Delta flight at 6:35 a.m., she went ballistic. She called me an incompetent idiot, asked me over and over what good an assistant was if I couldn't do something as simple as arrange for a private plane.
She sniffed and took a sip of something, probably coffee. Oh my God, I know what you're gonna say. Tell me you didn't.
I did.
You didn't. You've got to be kidding.
For 15 minutes? I did. What choice did I have? She was really unhappy with me. At least this way it seemed like I was actually doing something. It came to another couple $1,000s, not exactly a big deal. She was bordering on happy when we hung up. What else can you ask for?
By this point, we'd both started laughing. I knew without Emily's telling me, and she knew I knew, that she'd gone ahead and purchased 2 additional business class tickets on the Delta flight for Miranda just to shut her up, to make the incessant demands and insults finally, blissfully cease. I was nearly choking at this point.
So wait, by the time you arranged for a car to take her to the Delano...
It was just before 3 in the morning, and she'd called my cell phone exactly 22 times since 11. The driver waited while they showered and changed in their penthouse suite, and then took them right back to the airport in time for their earlier flight.
Stop! You've got to stop!
I howled, doubled over at this charming series of events.
This did not really happen.
Emily stopped laughing and tried to feign seriousness.
Oh, really? You think all of this is good? I haven't even told you the best part.
Oh, tell me, tell me.
I was positively gleeful that Emily and I had for once managed to find something funny at the exact same time. It felt good to be part of a team, one half in the battle against the oppressor. I realized then for the first time what a different year it would have been if Emily and I could have truly been friends. If we could have covered and protected and trusted each other enough to face Miranda as a united front, things probably wouldn't have been quite so unbearable. But except for rare times like these, we didn't agree on just about everything.
The best part of all of it?
She was silent, dragging out the joy we shared a few moments longer.
She didn't realize this, of course. But even though the Delta flight took off earlier, it was actually scheduled to land 8 minutes after her original Continental.
Shut up,
I'd howled, delighted with the delicious new nugget of information.
You've got to be kidding me.
When we finally hung up, I was surprised to see that we'd been talking for more than an hour, just like a couple of real friends would. Of course, we immediately reverted back to just contained hostility on Monday, but my feelings for Emily were always a bit more affectionate after that weekend. Until now, of course. I sure didn't like her enough to hear whatever surely irritating or inconvenient thing she was preparing to dump on me.
Really, you sound horrible. Are you sick?
I tried valiantly to interject a touch of sympathy in my voice, but the question came out sounding aggressive and accusatory.
Oh, yeah,
she rasped before breaking into hacking coughs.
Really sick.
I never really believed it when anyone said they were really sick. Without a diagnosis of something very official and potentially life-threatening, you were well enough to work at Runway. So when Emily finished hacking and reiterated that she was really ill, I didn't even consider the possibility that she wouldn't be at work on Monday. After all, she was scheduled to fly to Paris to meet Miranda on October 18th, and that was only slightly more than a week away. And besides, I'd managed to ignore a couple strep throats, a few bouts of bronchitis, a horrific round of food poisoning, and a perpetual smoker's cough and cold, and hadn't even taken a single sick day in nearly a year of work. I'd sneaked into a single doctor's appointment when I was desperate for antibiotics with one of the cases of strep throat. I ducked into his office and ordered them to see me right away when Miranda and Emily thought I was out scouting for new cars for Mr. Tomlinson. But there was never time for preventative work. Although I'd had a dozen sets of highlights from Marshall, quite a few free massages from spas that felt honored to have Miranda's assistant as a guest, and countless manicures, pedicures, and makeovers, I hadn't seen a dentist or a gynecologist in a year.
"Anything I can do?"
I asked, trying to sound casual, while I racked my brain thinking of why she'd call to tell me that she didn't feel well. As far as we were both concerned, it was completely and entirely irrelevant. She'd be at work on Monday whether she felt well or not. She coughed deeply, and I heard phlegm rattling in her lungs.
Yeah, actually. God, I can't believe this is happening to me.
What's happening?
I can't go to Europe with Miranda.
I have mono.
What?
You heard me. I can't go. The doctor called today with the blood results, and as of right now, I'm not allowed to leave my apartment for the next 3 weeks.
3 weeks? She had to be kidding. There wasn't time to feel badly for her. She just told me she wasn't going to Europe. And it was that thought alone, the idea that both Miranda and Emily would be out of my life, that had sustained me through the past couple months.
Em, she's gonna kill you. You have to go. Does she know yet?
There was a foreboding silence on the other end.
Yeah. She knows.
You called her?
Yes. I had my doctor call her, actually, because she didn't think that having mono really qualified me as sick. So he had to tell her that I could infect her and everyone else, and anyway...
Her sentence trailed off, and her tone was suggestive of something far, far worse.
Anyway, what?
My self-preservation instincts had kicked into overdrive.
Anyway, she wants you to go with her.
She wants me to go with her, huh? That's cute. What did she really say? She didn't threaten to fire you for getting sick, did she?
Andrea, I'm...
A deep, mucousy cough shook her voice, and I thought for a moment that she might very well die right there on the phone with me.
Serious. Completely and totally serious. She said something about the assistants they give her abroad being idiots, and that even you'd be better to have around than them.
Oh, well, when you put it like that, sign me up. Nothing quite like some over-the-top flattery to convince me to do something. Seriously, she shouldn't have said such nice things. I'm blushing.
I didn't know whether to focus on the fact that Miranda wanted me to go to Paris with her, or that she only wanted me to go because she considered me slightly less brain-dead than the anorexic French clones of, well, me.
Oh, just shut up already.
She croaked in between fits of now annoying coughing.
You're the luckiest fucking person in the world. I've been waiting 2 years, over 2 years, for this trip, and now I can't go. The irony of this is painful. You realize that, don't you?
Of course I do. It's one giant cliché. This trip is your sole reason for living, and it's the bane of my existence, yet I'm going and you're not. Life is funny, huh? I'm laughing so hard I can barely stop.
I deadpanned, sounding not the least bit amused.
Yeah, well, I think it sucks too, but what can you do? I already called Jeffy to tell him to start calling in clothes for you. You'll have to bring a ton, since you'll need different outfits for each of the shows you attend. Any dinners, and of course, for Miranda's party at the Hotel Cost. Allison will help you out with makeup. Talk to Steph and accessories for bags and shoes and jewelry. You only have a week, so get on it first thing tomorrow, okay?
I still don't really believe she expects me to do this.
Well, believe it, because she sure wasn't kidding. Since I'm not going to be able to come to the office at all this week, you're also going to...
What? You're not even going to come into the office?
I might not have taken a sick day or spent a single hour outside the office while Miranda was there, but Emily hadn't either. The one time it had been close, when her great-grandfather had died... She'd managed to get home to Philadelphia, attend the funeral, and be back at her desk without missing a minute of work. This was how things worked. Period. Short of death, immediate family only, dismemberment, your own, or nuclear war, only if confirmed by the U.S. government to be directly affecting Manhattan, one was to be present. This would be a watershed moment in the priestly regime.
Andrea, I have mononucleosis. I'm highly infectious. It's really serious. I'm not supposed to leave my apartment for a cup of coffee. Never mind, go to work for the day. Miranda understands that, and so you'll need to pick up the slack. There will be a lot to do to get both of you ready for Paris. Miranda leaves on Wednesday for Milan, and then you'll be leaving to meet her in Paris the following Tuesday.
She understands that. Come on, tell me what she really said.
I refused to believe that she'd accepted something as mundane as mono for an excuse not to be available.
Just give me that small pleasure. After all, my life will be hell for the next few weeks.
Emily sighed, and I could feel her eyes roll over the phone.
Well,
She wasn't thrilled. I didn't actually talk to her, you see, but my doctor said she kept asking if mono is a real disease. But when he assured her that it was, she was very understanding.